Well, this is the last episode of the podcast, so hey everybody.
I have a new microphone that picks up literally everything, and I'm still trying to figure out how to use it. And then a couple weeks ago, you sent me a thing that said, "Hey, you're never allowed to make fun of how much noise I make." and all I can hear, like, I think I have it down better, like what levels to set it at.
Right.
But like, it's like I could hear the saliva in my mouth, and I'm sure the listeners could too. And I'm like, this is terrible. This is like watching yourself in high definition.
Yeah, and that's good. That's what you wanted, right? That's why you bought a microphone that could, you know, hear everything.
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah. I mean, I'm an only the best kind of guy.
How you doing, Bobby?
I'm doing good. We record these usually on like lazy weekend mornings.
Yeah.
And
it is Sunday morning currently. I'm a little tired.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. And I just want to throw this out there. I vouch heavily for Trader Joe's crumpets. They're good. I had one for breakfast.
What is a crumpet? Is that a kind of scone or biscuit?
A crumpet is like the closest relative would be like an English muffin. It's okay. Like an eggy English muffin.
Oh.
I don't know if eggy is right either. It's just a...
Weird. That is not what I was picturing at all. It's one of those words I've been hearing my whole life, and I don't actually know what it means. You know?
There's a crumpet place in Seattle that's really, really good.
Yeah.
And I went there, and I realized, like, oh, I think I really like crumpets. But Trader Joe's sells them for cheap, and they're not, I mean, as good as that, but they're pretty good.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to the Crumpet and Audio Recording Podcast, where we only talk about pastries from Trader Joe's and how we record our podcast. I'm Ian. This is Bobby.
You're wrong with Ian and Bobby, you're wrong.
How you doing this week, man?
Pretty good, Ian. I'm glad that we pointed out who we are, because I think we take for granted that people just know which voice belongs to which person.
I think we take for granted people listen to the show, personally, but yeah, I suppose that's...
No, we get like a million listeners every week.
Yeah? A million?
Yeah. A million. 1 million. That is 6 zeros.
Well, I'm curious to see how the beginning of the podcast goes this week, because as far as I can tell, you and I are doing the exact same things that we were doing last time we recorded, which is to say, you're doing nothing but playing Pokemon Let's Go Pikachu, and I'm doing nothing but playing Red Dead Redemption 2. Would you say that's an accurate representation of our lives lately, Bobby?
I mean, that is a facet of my life, but, for sure.
But you're so many other things.
Do you have anything new to talk about?
You know, I did...
Or should we just call it a day right now?
I know. I started, so my house is being kind of renovated currently. We had a bit of a crazy thing happen a month ago where we just found a ton of black mold in our kitchen and we had to tear the whole thing out. So I have my PlayStation downstairs, which I think I maybe have said before, and because there's so much going on down there, I haven't had a ton of opportunities to play. So I'm playing a little slower than I normally would on that game. And because of that, I have a PlayStation 3 in my room, and I decided to try out Red Dead Redemption, the first one, and see what I remembered and, you know, what it felt like. And there's a lot to that game still.
Yeah.
I mean, this new one adds a lot of things, and I want to talk about what they are. I kind of want to wait until you start playing to really do that, so I'm going to hold off on it. But that was a very complete game the first time around. It's still pretty impressive. Other than that, what have I been doing? I watched Creed 2 this weekend. It was great.
Oh, was it really great?
Yeah, it's not as good as the first one. It's not as interesting as the first one. It's more of a formulaic, straightforward boxing movie. But I love boxing movies, so I was very happy with it. Tessa Thompson is great, and Michael B. Jordan is great, and Stallone is always pretty fantastic in those movies. He does a good job of playing the kind of palooka old Rocky, and it's fun to watch. So yeah,
I really, really loved Creed.
Yeah, me too.
I really like the first Rocky movie also.
Yeah.
I
don't know if you know this about me. I've been a big Rocky nerd kind of my whole life. Like
Really?
Other than 5, I kind of really like all of them. I have never seen Balboa, because it looked insanely stupid. And then, so I've seen 1 through 4 quite a lot, and I've seen Creed and Creed 2 now. But yeah, I'm a fan of that world, even though it's kind of stupid sometimes.
The premise of Apollo Creed's son doing a big fight against Ivan.
I get it. I know, but they do. I mean,
is it good though?
Yeah, it's fine.
It's good.
I mean, so okay. Like, Drago, Ivan Drago's the bad guy in a believable way. His son is. They do a good job of making the son kind of like a converted accomplice to this revenge mission, which makes him kind of interesting. He is bad too, but because his dad's been filling his head with bullshit his whole life, and you can kind of see that. So it's interesting. It's a good movie. It's a really good movie. And they continue along with the degenerative hearing disease that Tessa Thompson's character has in some interesting ways in this new movie too.
Oh, so, great.
Yeah.
God, I love Tessa Thompson.
I do always kind of have this, and it's not her fault at all. It's probably something that's going to just curse her for the rest of her life. But the actress, I'm ashamed to say I don't remember her name off the top of my head, who plays Bill Cosby's wife in The Cosby Show, who plays Creed's mom.
Come on.
Yeah, I know.
It's, yeah.
I know. I'm embarrassed because she's great. But I every time I see her now, I just am reminded that Bill Cosby is a bad person. And that's, like, it's not her fault. It's just she's probably the face most associated with Bill Cosby in the world other than Bill Cosby himself. So that's always an interesting experience.
Like, she defended him and stuff.
Oh, did she?
Pretty quickly, I believe. I don't want to say that. That's
not her. I mean, here's the thing. Like, Bill Cosby's a bad person. Everyone else around him was scared and sad and confused. I'm kind of fine with how anybody else reacted to that situation. He's the villain of that story. But, like...
Felicia Rashad.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. But she's great in it. And, yeah. I don't know. It's a great movie. It's really fun. I liked it a lot.
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. What else have I been doing... Yeah, let's talk about Supernatural, Bobby.
Oh, yeah. Supernatural, my favorite show. I love this show. I've watched it for, like, 9 seasons, but Ian always makes fun of me for it, which is unfortunate, because it's a good show, dude. You'd really, really dig it.
Bobby has never seen Supernatural, and it's one of my guilty pleasures, and I have been kind of diving back into it lately. So, yeah. Everybody I know, go ahead and make fun of me for liking Supernatural. It's a good show.
It's supernaturally good. I've been listening to a ton of podcasts, like a lot of podcasts.
Yeah, what have you been listening to?
Mostly like non-fiction stuff.
Okay.
I've been just like every time someone pops up like a best podcast of the year list, I've just been scouring all the podcasts on it.
Right.
But there's one that I really, really got into, and it's like a top 5 for me now.
What is it?
I sent it to you. It's called The Habitat.
Oh, that's right. I still need to listen to all I know about it is the cover art, and it looks cool.
It's the cover art is an astronaut on Mars with a little dome behind him or her.
Mm-hmm.
But the premise of this podcast is, so NASA has this group called High Seas, and the idea behind their work is that when we finally send people to Mars,
mm-hmm.
Because of the distance between Earth and Mars, the first people to go to Mars will potentially have to be there for like up to a year.
Right.
Until the distance between the planets closes and they can make the journey safely.
Sure.
And so, in Hawaii, they have set up this habitat that, replicates the habitat that people would be able to set up on Mars.
Sorry, this is nonfiction. So,
yeah, it's nonfiction.
Oh, wow, okay.
And so they do these studies where they will... And the podcast follows the longest study they did,
mm-hmm.
where they take 6 people with, like, science or science-adjacent backgrounds and lock them in this habitat for a year.
Wow.
And so it follows these 6 people. They're all pretty young. I think it's... the oldest it's like between the ages of 25 and 35, and they all A journalist gives them a recorder on their way in, them living under these conditions that they would have to live under in Mars, but their only social interaction for
is with
a
each year other, yeah.
is these five other people that they're stuck in the habitat with. And it's just really, it's really fun to listen to.
Do they have to go do like immunity challenges and, you know, like...
No. I mean, yes, it is essentially a reality show, but like, it's interesting. Like whenever they leave the habitat, they have to wear their, you know, their spacesuits to leave the habitat.
Sure.
They can only eat food that they'd be able to bring to Mars.
Right.
They have access to like very limited internet and email, but it's like on a 20 minute delay
because that's what it would be. That's so fascinating. Yeah, that sounds amazing.
I got to the end of it and then started it over and listened to the whole thing.
Okay.
Because I thought it was so interesting.
All right. I'll check it out. I saw something online the other day that made me laugh in terms of its truth, which was somebody tweeted, "It's weird to think that one of the planets in our solar system right now is entirely inhabited by robots."
Yeah. I saw that too.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. What have I been doing? I've been listening to a lot of podcasts too, same as always. Listen to a lot of My Favorite Murder, always a good one. Yeah, man, other than Supernatural and Red Dead Redemption 2, I don't have a lot to talk about this week, and I can't talk about Red Dead Redemption 2 until you played it, and I can't talk about Supernatural until you admit that it's actually a beautiful, artful, serious show. I'm kidding, by the way. I do love Supernatural, but for the record, I love that show in the same way that I would say you probably love some of your more eye-rolly shows. It definitely is a guilty pleasure series, so don't.
There are no eye-rolly shows I like.
Don't sell. Yeah, none at all. You've never, not Glee, not, I don't know, what else? Riverdale, none of those.
Those both have solid first seasons and terrible future seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And they both had the, well, no, I was going to say they both had the decency to end, but Riverdale still lives.
Supernatural's on season 13 right now.
Yeah, yeah. Cool.
Well,
you know,
hey,
I just realized thing about myself as we were talking about what we've been doing. I'm like, what other podcasts have I been listening to? Like, end of the year lists will, like, obviously, you know, they compile the best podcasts of the year, but the ones that make an impact are often, like, heavy, if that makes sense.
Sure, sure.
And so I listened to Serial Season 3, which is incredible, but is really, really depressing.
They're already on Season 3? Oh, my God. I have never listened to an episode of Serial, for the record.
Serial Season 3 is the best one. I have a feeling it won't be the most popular, because it's not, like, a murder mystery, but she embeds herself... She and her reporters embed themselves in the Cleveland courthouse system, and it's like they kind of follow a lot of stories and uncover a lot of systemic injustices in the court system there. Yeah,
okay.
It's a bummer.
Yeah, that's a real bummer.
I've been listening to an NPR podcast about Larry Nassar, who's the U.S. gymnastics doctor who,
So really so just kind of like happy-go-lucky type of stuff is what you're listening
and then,
to. And
then, I listened to an ESPN podcast about Bikram yoga, which, again, involved a lot of, the premise of that is that, I mean, that the guy who ran Bikram yoga sort of ended up running his own, like, cult within his company and ended up sexually assaulting a bunch of people.
Oh,
and
wow.
Then I listened to The Habitat, and so I'm like, The Habitat's amazing.
Nobody gets assaulted. Nobody dies. Nobody gets like convicted of crimes they didn't commit, sent to jail for the rest of their lives.
I'm gonna listen to it again right now.
You know, I actually do have something I want to talk about briefly before we move into what we're going to talk about this week, which is I feel like we're in a new era of Netflix, which is they're finally actually canceling shit, and it's breaking my heart. We lost American Vandal this month, which was truly heartbreaking. And then for me, I know you don't care as much about this one, but Daredevil is gone, which
for my mind
was the most pound for pound, you know, strong Netflix Marvel show, and I will say, I finished the third season. I again will say that it's a fucking excellent third season of that show. Strongest of the series in my mind so far. And I did, when I finished it, think, oh, this is cool, because if the show gets canceled, this is a great way to end it. So, I mean, it has an end, but still, fuck that.
With Daredevil, and with inevitably what I believe will happen to Jessica Jones,
right,
too.
Right.
I think it has probably, this is my guess, it has less to do with Netflix and more to do with Disney. Like,
oh, I agree. I realize, yeah, that. It's just, you know, I like this thing.
Disney's on the eve of launching their own streaming service, and they're kind of gathering all their properties back to their center. And so, like, I think they even said that Daredevil's going to appear in other Marvel properties and stuff.
Oh, of course. But, well, by the way, interestingly, because he kind of forgot about this, when they were first doing it, they were really touting the fact that, remember, there was a big story at the time that Charlie Cox was going to show up as Daredevil in Civil War and all kinds of stuff like that. There was a lot of promises made, which, honestly, I don't want that. I don't really need these to be part of the same world. I just like the Daredevil show. But yeah,
I'm gonna make another guess. I think Ike Perlmutter, is he the president of Marvel? He's in a high leadership position there. He runs all their TV properties. I think he really wanted to do kind of a bigger extended universe that included Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Netflix
and
then I think Kevin Feige got the reins to the movies and was just like, fuck you, I don't want to do it.
right. I like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I like Daredevil. I don't need either of those shows to actually... I think Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. really comes into its own when it just becomes its own thing. The first season, you know, like, throwing these kind of, like, really pat on the head cameos, like, you know, Thor's Norse girlfriend and stuff like that is just kind of silly. But yeah.
I think we go through, we're going through a cycle too with the Marvel Extended Universe stuff, where it was very exciting, especially during phase one.
Sure.
To get this, like, big build up to all these characters meeting.
Well, and Avengers was still, I mean, I remember still in theaters just being like, holy shit, they did it. Like, that's, you know.
Yeah. Oh, it was one of the most exciting movie experiences I've had in theaters.
Yeah.
And not that we don't still like seeing these characters meet, but I think we are now at the point where we're appreciating when these stories don't feel beholden to the overarching story.
Right.
Like, we...
Well, and there's a nice balance right now. Like, I really liked I like Infinity War more than you do, but also, you know, like, Ant-Man 2, there's like a little nod to Infinity War at the end, but really it's a pretty self-contained, fun, cool movie. So yeah, I agree.
And Civil War is one of my favorite Marvel movies, in it.
Totally.
It's very much tied to the bigger whole. But it's just kind of like, it's nice to be able to, like, cool, I don't have to do any homework.
Yes. It does feel, I think a lot of people, you know, I've talked to a lot of people recently who are like, yeah, I'm burnt out, and I get it. You know, my friend came and visited me a few months ago, and he was like, let's catch up on the Marvel movies. And when we watched Infinity War and it ended, he was just like, wait, this is the first half of a movie? Fuck you, Ian. And, you know, I get it. So,
I do laugh, though. There's a... I always laugh. There's a few properties when critics write about them.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel's one where it's like Marvel movies pretty much consistently are critically well received.
Sure. Yeah, I agree.
I'm not saying they're the best movies ever, but for the most part, people, you know, like, shake their head and go, yeah, sure, thumbs up, you know.
Yeah.
It gets to the point where every Marvel movie is like, hey, you might be sick of the MCU fatigue like I am, but this movie's pretty good.
A lot of people, I do feel like that MCU fatigue is bullshit at this point, because everyone says it all the time, but it seems like no one's actually experiencing it, because everyone's still seeing these movies. So, like,
I've seen it happen with consecutive movies, and I'm like, oh,
You know what I think that is more? I think it's people trying to stay interesting because everyone just loves the Marvel movies. And so you don't want to just be like, I love them too. Here's why this one's great. Because then, like, you're not an interesting critic. Like, I feel like that's a symptom of hot take culture a little bit.
Or maybe it's just the way it settles in people's brains where they're just like, yeah, I'm really sick of the MCU because there's so many of these. Oh, God.
But this one's great.
Infinity War was great. Yeah, and I'm like, you just... I'm not like... Again, I'm not like, this is not me jumping to the defense of the MCU, because I love the MCU. I have problems with the MCU.
I'm Bobby. I'm like, so interesting. I have problems with the MCU.
I know. I'm super interesting.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, here's the thing. Bobby has a little bit of MCU fatigue, but this newest movie is really great.
It is. Yeah, it's true. I'm a very interesting person. The other property I've noticed people, there's a formula to the reviews, mm-hmm. is the Zelda series. Every single, I'm not even kidding. If you go back and look at every major console Zelda release since like Majora's Mask, every single one of them starts with like, Zelda series has had a lot of trouble finding its footing.
This is the return.
Ocarina of Time.
This is the return to Zelda. Yeah.
And then I'm like, 10 out of 10, and then, you know, like, well, Skyward Sword failed to meet the expectations of many people, but Breath of the Wild really got there.
But then you go back, and they gave fucking Skyward Sword a 10 out of 10.
It's interesting.
I agree. I think here's what it is. Zelda games, at least specifically, always are so good that it feels like you're rediscovering Zelda for the first time, and I don't think people know how to articulate that clearly, and so they assume in their brains, their brain does this thing where they go, well, I'm having so much fun playing this, I must have hated the last one. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I also think with I don't want to use the term games journalism because it comes with such like loaded shit when you complain about it.
I don't know what you could possibly be talking about. Bobby, by the way, do you mind if we set like 10 minutes aside so I can talk about something called Depression Quest today? It's really, really important. I have some serious things to say about it.
Yeah. Oh boy. I think
if you don't know what we're talking about, don't look it up because it's sad.
No, look up Depression Quest. It's a great
game. Oh, Depression Quest is a great game.
Do not look up. And Zoe Quinn's a really interesting figure. Don't look up any of the criticism against her because it's all bullshit.
And if you're a fan of Firefly, especially, don't look it up because you'll be sad for the rest of your life.
You'll be so sad. Oh my God. nothing matters.
Well,
no, what I was gonna say is, go ahead. I think with games journalism, every time like a big tentpole game comes out, people lose their shit and feel obligated to like Skyward Sword comes out. I'm not saying Skyward Sword isn't a good game. I haven't beaten it, but it seemed really good from what I played. People are like, Zelda's the greatest. It's as good as everyone thinks it is. 10 out of 10,
right?
Because like, there's a weird hype culture in video games.
Well, that's what I was...
that I don't think exists.
Yeah, what I was going to say is, like, it's not even just hype culture, because the thing with video games is, I think in that world, almost all the people who play video games, and I'm guilty of this myself, still have it in their heads that they're going to get beat up if they admit to people they play video games. Like, there's this weird nerd thing associated with it, and so I feel like when these new games, like you said, like these new tentpole games come out that everyone's into, it has to be the celebration of the game and gaming rather than, like, I think it's impossible to separate in games journalism fandom from criticism in a lot of ways, and that's true of the, obviously, like the people reading that journal, that stuff, but also other than maybe like 3 or 4 critics I really, really enjoy, I mean, most of these people are writing essays to their friends saying, hey, this new thing came out and we're all excited about it. And that's great. I don't know if that's necessarily criticism of anything, you know?
See, I don't know if that is true, because video games, I mean, like, there is a cultural...
I'm talking about, like, sort of IGN and Game Informer and, like, the
basic...
But no,
that's what I'm agreeing with. IGN is a... And Game Informer are massive, massive sites that bring in millions and millions of impressions and do tons of ad revenue, and video games are a massive, gigantic industry that makes billions of dollars.
Right.
You know, like, I think people at IGN and people at, you know, EA don't look at what they're doing as, like, this, you know, this, like, niche nerd thing.
But I think the individual writers don't. I think the way they talk about, because I think that's why there's such a need to, like, give a 10 out of 10. I feel like the 10 out of 10 has become this thing of, like, we're excited there's a new version of this game, and it's not actually about the game itself. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I'm making this up as I go. I'm not, like, working on a dissertation on this stuff, but
there is, like, a uniformity in video game reception that there isn't often in movies.
That's kind of what I mean. Like, everybody's afraid to be the first one to say, like, hey, this thing is weird, or, like, I don't know. Although, I think
a big thing that video game criticism, this is going to sound very pretentious, I think a big thing video game criticism could do to, like, sort of improve the quality of conversation around video games is to get rid of scores.
Yeah, like, well, and also part of the problem with video games is that, like, I think it ends up being a justification of why you spent 200 hours doing a thing, which is not a thing you have to worry about when you're talking about movies or TV shows or anything like that. You know, you don't have to justify that much time put into it. And so there's almost this kind of readiness to fight back and say, like, no, I'm not an asshole who spent 200 hours pretending to be a cowboy. Like, this is a good experience, you know? I don't know.
There's also, like, the video game fandom, I think, is, I mean, we're not saying anything, you know, revolutionary.
It's perfect, like, is what you were going to say. Up. There's no problems in it at all.
But, like, if Breath of the Wild had come out, okay, Jim Sterling, who's a YouTube person, I often watch, I often disagree with, I often agree with, he reviewed Breath of the Wild and gave it, like, a 7 out of 10. And he, you know, a lot of the mechanics that frustrated me early on that I came to appreciate, he didn't like, but he, like, a 7 out of 10 is still a good review.
Sure.
And he still said a lot of good things about it. He ended it with a 7 out of 10, and people lost their minds.
Of course it did.
Like, launched
well,
DV
because they, and that's
OS
what I mean. Those people
website.
All feel like they are being attacked and told that the experience that they have just put 400 hours into isn't the most divine, perfect, awe-inspiring, religious experience they've ever had. And then all of a sudden they feel stupid, and so they react in anger, and they're like, oh, you're calling me, stupid. I don't know.
But I also think if you publish that exact same review and erase the 7 at the end of it.
Yes, exactly.
People have to read and think more critically of, instead of
scrolling to
the bottom and going, 7 out of 10? Fuck you.
So basically,
you know?
What you're saying is the world would be a better place if people read the whole article?
Yeah, and if we didn't have to immediately translate our opinions on a thing into a letter, grade,
right.
or numbers.
I mean, that's always going to be the case, though. I don't think that'll ever go away.
But I don't, like, movie reviews, there are places that give star ratings, but there are many, many outlets that don't.
Yeah, but the infrastructure in places is designed around Metacritic, so those places are never going to be
such bullshit, though.
I understand.
Metacritic
I'm just saying,
should
like,
fuck
like,
off
I,
forever.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with everything you're saying. I just don't think it's ever
going
to.
Like, video game studios tie bonuses to Metacritic scores and stuff. Did you know that?
Yes, I did,
That's
actually.
Such bullshit.
It's crazy.
That's awful.
Yeah, the whole system's kind of broken. Anyway, let's talk about Spider-Man.
Yay! Spider-Man does whatever a spider can.
My thing is better than your thing.
All right, so I am very excited to talk about this today. A little bit of background. We read about 10 issues, 9 or 10 issues of Amazing Spider-Man. This is during J. Michael Straczynski's run, during 2001, which we'll get to for obvious reasons in a few minutes. This was maybe the first modern comic book I ever bought with my own money. I went to a Barnes & Noble and bought the Moreland first 6-issue storyline as a trade paperback when I was in 6th grade, and I read it hundreds of times. So for me, this is also a little bit of a nostalgia trip, especially that first storyline. I kind of want to just hear what you have to say about it for a while, and I'll maybe jump in. So we kind of, I think we can easily break this into three categories, because there's three things I want to talk about today. The Moreland story is pretty self-contained, so I think that's a good story to talk about. Then we have our very bizarre and interesting and strange 9/11 issue, and then there's these two other issues after, the conversation and the silent issue that I want to talk about. So I thought maybe we could do the conversation and the silent issue together, the 9/11 issue in the middle, and then start off by talking about Moreland a little bit.
Okay.
So first off, yeah, why don't you just kind of get us started, I guess.
If everyone takes kind of their knowledge of Spider-Man, what they know about Spider-Man.
Sure.
One of them is, I mean, the key thing, I think, is that Spider-Man, more than any other superhero, is kind of your everyday dude.
Sure.
Dealing with personal issues.
Yeah.
And what I found immediately very refreshing about the run of issues you gave me is we meet Spider-Man. We meet Peter Parker on hard times. Like, he's not in a good place mentally.
This is J. Michael Straczynski just took over the book right after somebody else had Mary Jane leave him. So at this point she is in LA.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, Mary Jane, I don't exactly remember the circumstances of that, but Mary Jane is right now living in LA trying to become a professional actress. I mean, it's pretty standard, like, oh, I know you're Spider-Man, but also, like, I can't handle you being Spider-Man stuff. It's nothing, you know, it's like one of those fights where it's nobody's fault, but they're split up. So he's starting a new chapter in his life. And JMS uses that as a way to kind of jumpstart a lot of interesting new things with the character that I like a lot.
And what I think is interesting or good, I know the comics have done this more often, but you know, that a few years after this was published and for about a decade, brooding superheroes were popular.
Sure.
But the way that Peter Parker broods is it's markedly different.
It's so sweet than, yeah, I know, he doesn't ever feel, yeah, like he's,
it's
whining.
So relatable. Yeah. Like, he's not this whiny little shit. You feel exhausted.
Yeah.
With him,
yeah.
You know? You're like, yeah, it must be really hard being you, dude. You know, he's still, you know, in his monologue trying to crack jokes, but he just sounds so tired. Yeah.
Yeah. And, and one of my favorite things about this first storyline, one of the reasons I gave it to you is I grew up reading Spider-Man comics. I used to read all the Stan Lee and Steve Ditko stuff back in the day. And whenever the best classic Stan Lee and Steve Ditko stories follow this fun, really fun for me formula, which is Peter meets some crazy new bad guy. The bad guy kicks his ass. He is very sad. And then he learns from his personal life, usually from his relationship with his aunt, that, yeah, like, Peter can beat this guy. Spider-Man maybe can't, right? Spider-Man's not strong enough, but, like, Peter is smart, and Peter knows how to do things. And I think it's really, really fascinating that Peter Parker is one of the few mainstream superhero characters who has a matriarch as a mentor rather than a patriarch. Most of these characters have, you know, Alfred or something like that. And this sweet old lady who loves Peter and thinks he's a good boy and tells him that in a way that he, like, can take that and use it to beat the bad guys is great to me. I always really love that. And I feel like this storyline really follows that in some fun new ways.
You know, it's interesting. Yeah. Spider-Man is, I would argue, the most iconic and most recognizable out of all the Marvel superheroes.
Sure.
But he's never, with reason, with good reason, he's never allowed to mature into the leader, you know, like,
right,
he's never,
right,
we never really,
right,
see him depicted as the guy who has his shit together.
Well,
and teaching other people.
And one of the things that J. Michael Straczynski always does with him, which I really like, is his Peter just wears his need for a father figure on his sleeve so painfully. And mm-hmm. to the point where, like, we meet this new guy at the beginning of this. We meet this
Ezekiel,
who is this mysterious older guy, seems to have a lot of money. We don't know a lot about him, except for the fact that he also has spider powers and he knows who Peter is. And obviously Peter doesn't trust him from the beginning, but we see how quickly, the second Ezekiel, like, steps up for him towards the end of the book, how quickly he wants him to be his friend, you know? Like, Peter is so lonely. It makes me so sad. Anyway,
and he's constantly drawing comparisons between him and Uncle Ben.
Do you want to briefly tell people what this first storyline is about? Because I think we're kind of circling a little bit.
Yeah. The plot particulars, I think, are not as interesting as
That's fine.
Like the character implications.
Yeah, yeah.
But so Morlin, who is like a kind of a take on a vampire.
Yeah, he's like a superhero vampire. He has to eat. He eats energy from people who have animal powers. So
right.
First thing I want to say is, I really, really like the world building in this series. You just got a taste of it here. It opens up a lot more. A lot of people were very unhappy with what JMS did with this series in terms of bringing in the magical spider stuff a little bit more. Basically what he does is he says, like, hey, Spider-Man's always been a science fiction series. What if it was a series about magic a little bit more? And this guy has spider powers. Well, people have gotten animal powers in myths since the beginning of time. All of Peter's enemies dress like animals. Maybe there is some kind of, like, archetypal, you know, spider god type power stuff that's going on with him. And opening that up, I think, lends itself to some interesting opportunities moving forward. But a lot of people, you know, a lot of fans were freaked out the same way you might expect them to freak out if all of a sudden Peter became black
it's
or
kind
something
of like
that. There's a lot of like, no, not my Spider-Man kind of thing.
It's like what Julie Taymor did with Spider-Man in the Broadway Turn Off.
I strongly disagree. I hate you so much for even saying that. but I do, I think there's a few things I really like about J. Michael Straczynski's writing. I think that he has this very, very earnest, sweet, Frank Capra-esque sense of wonder about the world of superheroes, and I think it plays really well with Peter. And then also, he does New York so well. The kind of, like, just little crazy one-offs, like the crazy old lady who Peter interacts with, who hates the word bam and stuff like that. Like, he just does that stuff very, very well.
In which Peter follows a high school student home and then goes into her room.
So there is a lot of SJW social justice kind of stuff happening with this version of Peter. I cut you off. Why don't you say a little bit about what happens?
Still talking about Moreland?
Or you could talk about being a teacher. Peter Parker is a high school teacher. You could talk about what do you want to talk about?
Oh yeah. So that is with Moreland, I was gonna say, just to cleanly wrap Moreland up,
because
I think he's interesting, but he's the least interesting
thing
about
the
running.
Well, he's interesting because it's just a guy who's better than Peter. That's all that makes him interesting, and that makes Peter more interesting.
Well, and I was gonna thinking of things to say when we talked about it, and mm-hmm. I was going to summarize this as, you know, a guy with a disorder who requires blood,
right.
You know, being terrorized by this Spider-Man.
You're such an asshole.
But then the comic gets there, like, Peter finds out how to take down Moreland, and Moreland's immediately turned into this mess, and he's just like, please don't kill me, I'm sorry, I'm gonna leave, please just let me
go. And screaming like, you don't know how old I am, you can't do this, like, it's, yeah, he's immediately just like a quivering mess, who has never experienced pain before.
Yeah, and Peter recognizes that, and is like, I don't know what to do, like, this guy's gonna have to kill other people, but I am not totally cool with killing him,
right,
you know?
Right.
And then there's a... His Moreland's, I mean, he's the stand-in for, like, Moreland's familiar, Moreland's assistant who follows him around everywhere.
Right.
Finally realizes that Moreland is weak and kills him.
Yeah,
and you know, Peter, again, I mean, the guy does Peter's work for
him. I know,
or Spider-Man's
I know
work
that
for
is
him,
that is but, always that is a moment where I always roll my eyes. I'm like, okay, I mean, What else are you supposed to do but lazy writing?
I totally get why Peter would be like, I can't.
Oh, no, no, I can too. It just, it always feels like, you know, when in, you watch Smallville and people very conveniently, like, get knocked unconscious right before Clark Kent has to use his superpowers. It just feels kind of like that. Like, oh, it's a good thing there was another guy there who whose gun now works because Peter weakened him enough that, that Peter doesn't need to kill the bad guy now because Peter can't.
I think if we had spent a couple more pages with that guy, it would have worked.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you know, that is better. One of the only moments that I think is slightly weak. I think that the kind of carnage of Moreland, the swath of destruction he leads, and how beat up we see Peter get during all that, I think all that is really compelling. Seeing him try to kind of struggle to get away, struggle to figure out what to do, his costume just in tatters around him. By the way, one thing I have to say,
Peter has to change costumes
a couple of times.
That's fun to watch.
One thing I will say is John Romita Jr. is an extremely talented artist. I think some of his more recent stuff has become a little too angular for me, a little too kind of stylized, but this is the sweet spot, man. He is such a good artist here. And that coloring is amazing. It just feels... it feels modern, but it also feels like Stan Lee. You know what I mean? It feels like a comic book.
Yes.
It feels very classic in that way, and I love it.
I agree.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about 9/11.
So, on September 11th, 2001, as a joke, and then I realized, like, I don't want to make this joke. This is a terrible joke to make.
So, about a month after 9/11, Spider-Man released an issue that took place pretty much in the middle of a storyline. The first page says, we will shortly bring you back to your regularly scheduled programming. And then it's just 30 pages of Spider-Man talking about 9/11.
It's a black cover with no issue number, no writers on the cover either, I think.
Nothing. There's a few things I think are really interesting about this. This isn't bad. I wouldn't say it's bad. I'm not offended by it. It's strange. I think the moment that's strangest to me, which you also seem to react very strongly to, is there's a panel where Dr. Doom and Magneto and Kingpin are all crying about 9/11.
Yeah.
Because even they're not real monsters compared to the real monsters. I think the book does an interestingly good job of separating out Muslims from Muslim extremists in this book. I think that it has some interesting things to say about how we should have reacted after 9/11. But, I mean, end of the day, real weird impulse to make a superhero 9/11, like, therapy session. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a couple... I mean, there's a fork, I guess, where I'm like... okay, if we're looking at this on totally
the last panel is a splash page of all the Marvel superheroes standing together with EMS and New York Fire Department and police and all this stuff. Yeah. And there's a big splash panel halfway through where all of the superheroes are helping the EMS and cops sort through the rubble for survivors.
Right.
There's just a lot of that. It's very strange.
And I almost feel like the more interesting thing to do here, because okay,
something to remember and defend about this. This literally was written in the days after 9/11. Like, this is a person who has lost his goddamn mind, same as we all had at that time. Nobody knew how to react to that.
2018 me looks back on this and goes, but like, you know, Thor could have stopped it. You know?
Right, right.
If that makes sense. I'm looking at this and going, Spider-Man could have stopped those planes. You know, there's an accidental absurdity to the idea that, like, all these superheroes are brought
stumped
to their knees by
two
planes.
That
that's so comparatively weak to what they deal with in these issues.
Right.
And I almost think this is 2018 me talking. I'll go to 2001 in a second, but 2018 me thinks, like, this is an opportunity to break the fourth wall and to acknowledge that superheroes don't exist, but why we kind of look to them.
Well,
and it kind of does that
because he starts it off by saying, like, we weren't there, we didn't know, nobody could have known, this is crazy evil people doing crazy evil things. So that's all legitimate. But then also, by the way, I do want to say, I think JMS is a truther, because if you look at the panel where Wolverine wearing his New York Fire Department hat is cutting up steel girders with his adamantium claws, you can see those steel girders are not melted. So I'm just, I'm pointing that out. Anyway.
You know, Building 7 is still standing. Yeah.
This is a book that has Spider-Man swinging around and a panel that recreates the hostages who took the plane. Like, it's just a real weird combination of things.
And then in the middle of it, it cuts to the fucking insane Jerry Falwell comment about...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, how you know, he points a finger at you know, LGBTQ people. Yes. and pro-choice people. Yeah. And says, like, you know, you let this happen, fuck you.
And
forever.
Then after that, it has this really, really deadly serious moment where Spider-Man is watching Captain America be sad again because he remembered it also happening during Pearl Harbor. So it's like, it's like, well, where's reality here?
I think, if anything... It's the, okay, let me rewind.
I'm just excited we're talking about this, because this is one of the strangest artifacts I've ever seen, and it's fascinating.
It's interesting, because clearly this is not the issue you wanted to, that you didn't assign this run because of this
issue. I almost skipped this, and then I was like, you know what, this is going to be fucking fun to talk about, because it's weird.
It's so interesting as kind of an artifact. We did really silly shit in 2001, because we were all very emotional.
That's the thing, it's coming from such a place of like, confusion and hurt. I think in a lot of ways it really is. That's why I keep saying artifact. Like, it is a representation of how people felt immediately after.
And I think 15-year-old me could have picked up a comic and seen Dr. Doom. I would have fucking cried.
I liked
but
this
like
quite
now
a
I'm
lot
looking at this
15,
and I'm like, God, guy, it's so embarrassing. This is embarrassing.
Yeah, exactly. Especially because given everything we've said, like, everything leading up to this issue is very earnest and very kind of it's almost like an homage to the old 50s morality. Like, it's very simple. And this is just so not simple. I don't know. Anyway.
And at the time, to be fair, I mean, we were oversimplifying a lot.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Sure.
I remember like popular culture getting really weird. Like, I remember Fred Durst showing up on MTV and giving like heartfelt monologues about coming together and like singing ballads, you know, in support of first responders. It was a weird fucking time for popular culture.
One of the weirdest
makes sense to me.
One of the weirdest memories I have, and you will know this person's name, so I will tell you off air. But a friend of mine and I, this was freshman year in high school, for the record. Immediately after, started making flip books. We started buying the what?
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I yeah.
I hope that's okay. Do you think I should cut that out? I don't know. That just
No. I was gonna say I remember I got someone had sent me a chain email around this time, but it rewrote the whole thing about, you know, what Americans were going through in 9/11, but it rewrote the whole thing in the cadence of the How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Why? Wait, this happened soon after 9/11?
Yeah, 2001. Oh, it was just like, it was someone like rewrote How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
You need to
find this. But so I was like, you know, again, this is the Bobby who would have teared up at Dr. Doom tearing up. I was like, this is nice, and I forwarded on. But there was, we all grow, man. I'm going to admit something.
Well, so, I mean, we're allowed to be cynical about 9/11 now, because we have seen fucking 18 years of, like, exploitation in the name of 9/11 and all these other things, and we have learned a lot more about, you know, what we have done historically that caused the anger that led to these things, and, like, all this stuff. None of that existed at the time. Like, we were just, like, innocent people who had been punched in the face by somebody that ran by and our nose had gotten broken, and we were scared and, like, trying to make sense of everything.
And going back to what you said about, like, how we had a unify, like, we had Hitler for, that we didn't as a nation, I mean, Bin Laden is a fucking...
He's a monster. Evil, awful, obviously, human. Obviously.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not trying to, but, like, we didn't contemplate the nuances of that situation for a while.
Sure.
And so...
Say, like, 10 years or so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a year later, we were all screaming at each other about,
oil.
Going into Iraq and stuff.
Yeah.
But, there was a line in that chain email about, because there was a whole thing about Bin Laden, mm-hmm. and they wrote about him the same way Dr. Seuss wrote about the Grinch, and it made a reference to, like, maybe his turban was too tight.
Oh, no!
Yeah, and I sent that on, not thinking anything of it, and a friend I sent it to forwarded it on and copied me on it and wrote, this is really nice, but I could have done without the line about maybe his turban was too tight.
Sure, sure.
And I paused and was like, hey, wow, yeah, that's a little fucked up.
Yeah.
But I hadn't even considered it, because... Yeah. I don't know.
There was this weird moment, and I think it only lasted for a little while for a lot of people. For some people, it has never gone away. But for a lot of people, I think there was this moment where we got confused because, like, there's this hateable person in the world, and there's things about him physically you can identify easily and make fun of. But it, like, took us a minute to remember, like, oh, yeah, a lot of other people also look like that who aren't psycho. Yeah. Like, that just, like, took a minute. And so, yeah I think, I even looking back on, like, I wonder, honestly, sometimes if you talk to, like, Matt Stone and Trey Parker about the Durka, like, South Park episode with Bin Laden, and I don't know, that's, like...
Or fucking Team America.
Yeah,
also.
Well, yeah, maybe I guess Team America. But, like, yeah, there's, like, a lot of that. Like, everyone is like, oh, we're allowed to do this now because he's the bad guy, but, like, I don't know. Anyway... we're obviously the most equipped to talk about this stuff. But, yeah. Okay. So there's two other things I want to talk about. One we can talk about briefly, which is the Nuff Said episode. There was a month in 2002, I believe, where Marvel made every single magazine they published have no dialogue bubbles in it.
That's cool. Yeah. I didn't know
and
that.
So that's what that was. This was the Spider-Man version of that. And then there is also The Conversation, which is the big one I wanted to talk about. So the Moreland storyline ends with Peter having won, obviously, and collapsing in his room. And he is the most beat up we've ever seen him. He's been fighting for 3 days straight. His costume is, like, literally in tatters hanging off of his body. He collapses into his bed, passes out for 24 hours, and Aunt May walks in and sees him. And she goes off on her own and thinks about it for a day. There's an issue where that's happening. By the way, that storyline with the little girl continues. If you want to read more Spider-Man, that becomes a really, really fascinating, great storyline about homeless children.
Where Peter Parker enters a teenager's bedroom.
It's not her bedroom. It is behind a sheet in her hovel where she lives as a homeless person because he's trying to help her find her brother who's a drug addict, Bobby. Don't sully Peter Parker's
name. Is there anywhere private we can talk?
Oh my god, I know. When he does say, "Is there anywhere more private we can talk?" Yeah, that is a painful line. But yeah, so that happens. But then, Aunt May steals herself, shows up, and then we have this this story. This is one of my favorite single issues in comics. It's definitely one of my top five Spider-Man stories ever. Aunt May is amazing. I love Aunt May very, very much, and this is probably the reason why. I think Aunt May is kind of the perfect matriarch figure. Why don't we just talk about this issue for a little bit?
It's fucking great.
Yeah.
You had already told me.
Yeah, I kind of was bummed that this. I had ruined one thing because it's a really, really beautiful thing.
It still hit me, though. Yeah. It hit me like a ton of bricks, even though I knew it was coming.
Do you want to say what it was?
Yeah. Well, okay. So the whole issue is Aunt May. The one issue ends with Aunt May saying, hey, we need to talk.
Right.
And then this entire issue is her coming over to Peter's house. And
It's Peter. I believe it's Peter's apartment. Yes.
Okay. And she has his tattered Spider-Man costume, mm-hmm. and she tells him, like, she knows, and she feels really hurt and betrayed that Peter hasn't told her.
Of course, you know,
he's been lying to her for a number of years.
And this but is, it, and it is interesting because it's very rare in Spider-Man that we see Aunt May angry at Peter in a real way or hurt by Peter in a real way. And I feel like this is a moment of that. And they're, you know, I don't know. They capture the stakes to this conversation really effectively, I think.
Yeah. And it leads to a moment where Peter goes, another, you know, he mentions why he didn't want to tell her because, you know, he doesn't want her to be in danger.
Right.
And she kind of says, like, you know, that might be true, but that's also bullshit.
Well, and she, you are... there's a line where she says, what, did you think I was going to keel over and die the second I found out? Which is a little bit of a joke because that's literally what Stan Lee wrote Peter's fears to be. Like, he wrote Aunt May as elderly and as somebody who would literally fall over and die. which is not a great representation of women in the world, but it, you know, it's from the 60s.
Aunt May is often portrayed as like incredibly elderly.
Sure.
And Peter is often between the ages of 15 and 30, right? Why is she so old?
That is one of the strangest elements of that story. If you look at the old comics, she's drawn to look like she's 85 years old. It's very strange. I think it was an issue of Stan Lee being a young man who doesn't understand what oldness means.
There's kind of a joke in the new in Spider-Man Homecoming about Marissa Tomei being like a hot version of Aunt May, which again, Marissa Tomei is hot, but like when you think of Marissa Tomei is what, like 50?
Marissa Tomei is maybe even a little older than Peter's aunt would probably be. Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I talked about this last year on my on the other podcast I'm in Defense of Bad Movies. We're talking about Hook, I figured out Marissa Tomei was like 4 years younger than Maggie Smith was when in Hook.
Wait, is Marissa Tomei in Hook?
No. She in Spider-Man Homecoming is 4 years younger than Maggie Smith was in Hook. but I'm like, so everyone's talking about like, yeah, she's like a younger, hipper Aunt May, and I'm like, she's like 50 and Peter's 15. She's still a little old to be his aunt.
Yeah, it's
very strange. Anyway.
Yeah.
But so she calls him on it and says, like, hey, you just didn't want to face me. Like, you didn't want to deal with this moment here.
Yeah.
Which is like the moment of you having to come clean with me about something. And you know, Peter also mentions later on, he goes, another reason I couldn't tell you is because, you know, the reason I'm Spider-Man is because I, you know, let Uncle Ben die.
And he's scared during this one. He says, like, this one will kill you. And she kind of makes him tell her anyway.
And he mentions, you know, it's part of the Spider-Man origin story that everyone's heard a million times, which is, you know, he stood by and let a robbery happen. And that guy ended up killing Uncle Ben.
Right.
Which we know is bullshit because Sandman actually.
Fuck you. I hate that movie so much.
but Aunt May, you know, bursts into tears and goes, "Hey, I got into a fight with Ben earlier that day, and it wasn't a big fight. You know, it's just like we've been married for a long time.
And there's this line that really affects me where she says, like, he was a sweet man and he didn't like fighting, so he went for a walk. Like, and I was like, oh, I know that. Like, that's kind of my dad. Like, he's like, he just doesn't like being upset. And then he, like, I don't know. He writes Uncle Ben really well, too. There's a couple of great Uncle Ben moments later in this series.
And so Uncle Ben goes for a walk. And, you know, she says, you know, I never saw him again.
Yeah.
And if we hadn't gone to that fight, he wouldn't have gone on that walk. And, you know, like, he would still be
here. I mean, yeah. And the punchline is they both have been blaming themselves for this secretly, afraid to tell the other one for 15 years, you know?
And it's interesting because it sort of both absolves them of the guilt of Uncle Ben's murder, but it doesn't make that situation any easier.
No, of course. You know? And yeah, it completely changes how Peter is allowed to think about that, but also we know Peter well enough based on how he's been established in the series to know that, like, well, he's still always going to take that on as his responsibility. That's never going to go away.
Right.
But maybe he shouldn't hate himself so much for it, right? And, like, that moment, that panel, the single panel where Aunt May has this very sweet moment where she says, like, well, okay, so here's the thing. I've I'm not stupid. I've known you were hiding something your entire life. You've always been real shy and quiet and kind of awkward and weird around girls. I just assumed you were gay. And then she says, it's a really sweet line that could have come off as homophobic, but for some reason it doesn't. Where she says, I always assumed there was chiffon in your closet. I knew there was something in your closet. I thought it could have been chiffon instead of spandex. And he like starts laughing and picks her up, and he's crying. It's this like real moment of crying, and it's so strange to see a superhero comic where like the character is crying with his elderly aunt. I don't know. It's good, man.
It's really good. It's really good. And if I think this is a minor quibble,
please.
And I'm fine with the way it unfolds, but I almost think it would have been better if the comic ends with Peter feeling a little more emboldened.
Sure.
He's more secure, more proud to put on the Spider-Man outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And so he puts it on, goes to work being Spider-Man. Aunt May leaves his house stoic, and as she's leaving, as she's sitting in the cab, she's clearly not okay.
Right,
she's,
right.
And, she's a fucking mess.
And she has this really good moment before that, which I never thought about because it's just a great like kind of mom moment where she says, "Look, you're not gonna stop. I'm not stupid. I know you're not gonna stop. If I made you stop, you would either just hate me or Spider-Man would disappear and someone else would show up." And I was like, "Oh shit, that's exactly what would happen." Like, so she just gets Peter. But she also has this, the only person left in the world that she loves more than anything is like, could die any moment, you know? And anyway, so you said you were going to you would change something about that though.
Oh, and it's very minor. So we follow May and she's a fucking mess. And then Peter in his monologue acknowledges the personal sacrifice that May has made in putting on this front that she's like more okay with it than she is.
Right.
Even though she says she doesn't approve, she kind of like, but like, I almost wish Peter didn't acknowledge it and we still followed May, you know, like if that makes sense.
Yeah. Just, well, I do think there is an element to this where the tragicness of it is that Aunt May has decided to deal with some of the emotional fallout of this herself and protect Peter from it. And Peter like goes about his happy day. And there is a moment where you're like, fuck you, Peter. Like, look at this poor sad, look what you're doing to this woman. Like, but it's in a good way. Like it, I don't know. It all worked for me, but I get what you're saying.
Now, and again, it still works.
Yeah.
It's really good.
I almost, by the way, I almost only gave you the Moreland story and the conversation, but there is a moment in the Nuff Said episode, the next one, where Aunt May is writing emails to businesses that was so goddamn cute that I had to include it in there because I just really, really love the way Aunt May is written. Aunt May, her next thing that she does is go to the library. And one of my favorite things about it is that she writes her emails out longhand and then transcribes them on the computer, which is adorable. And she writes all of these talk shows and things like that, very obviously talking about Spider-Man in a way that she clearly knows who he is. Like calling him an occasional vegetarian and an overly sweet young man and things like that. It's just very, very cute. I love her.
But you're ignoring the real star of that final issue.
Yeah, what is that?
Which is Mary Jane's titties.
Which is what?
I'm joking. I said, which is Mary Jane's titties.
Yeah, okay. Wait. So I want to talk about that. So the next storyline, Peter goes to Hollywood, and it is about Mary Jane in Hollywood. And it's an interesting series because I think JMS is kind of like, what's his name? He's one of my favorite writers and you always make fun of him. The guy who wrote West Wing. What is wrong with me?
Sorkin.
He's quite like Sorkin in that, some of his, younger female characters are a little bit, cookie cutter, but I think he also does do a really good job of trying to make her like a tough, cool broad. So I encourage you to keep reading this. I think you will like his version of Mary Jane.
There's just something really funny about like Mary Jane is absent from this whole.
I know. This is set up for world building because the next issue, Peter and Aunt May go to Hollywood to try to talk to Mary Jane. So it's all set up for that, but you're right. It is a single, it's six pages of Mary Jane in a bathing suit, basically.
It's like, She's like asleep in a scandalous nightie. Yeah. She wakes up with the strap like down her shoulder.
She is a supermodel.
She takes a shower. And I'm like, what is happening? Yeah. Why are we doing this?
It is really funny. Some of the other Nuff Said issues are really, really funny because a lot of people really got into it and some people did not. And the people who didn't get into it were just like, fine, fuck it. Everyone's just going to be writing each other letters this whole issue. And so, but there is a little bit of that in this, you know, you have, Aunt May writing her emails, but overall I thought it was effective. I thought it was a really cool.
That was great. It was a good issue. I'm just laughing.
No, I know. It lends itself to a strange tone. Having no word bubbles feels, I don't know, it feels dreamier or something. It's kind of interesting. I really enjoyed it, but yeah. Anyway, so that's Spider-Man. That's J. Michael Straczynski's Spider-Man. He wrote about 80 issues, and John Romita Jr. did the art for the first 50 or so issues. Their run together is one of my favorites in comics, and it's really, really great. And unfortunately, about 8 years later, Marvel retconned all of this and made Aunt May forget who Peter was again. So fuck everything. But it's really, really well done.
I was going to ask, is this the first time that Aunt May finds out
Peter's identity? I believe so. There may have been something else in like the 70s or 80s that I'm unaware of, but this is the first one I ever saw, and it's, I think, the only one I've ever seen. Outside of, there's a really, really good Ultimate Spider-Man story where this happens as well. Bendis does a really good job with the same subject material.
Cool.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, that's Spider-Man. Thanks for reading it, man.
You know what? You're welcome. You're very, very welcome.
You're such a dick. So we talked last week about how we wanted to switch to doing just kind of one pick an episode. And I said, sure, that sounds good. Good idea, Bobby. And then Bobby texted me this week and said, hey, do you want to do two next week? Can we talk about our favorite movies? So, Bobby, why don't you defend your decision to just move back to what we were doing before and undo any changes? You want to retcon out the Aunt May-Peter conversation the same way that Marvel did.
Now, listen, this is very in keeping with what I suggested. I suggested we theme our episodes a little bit better, too.
And okay.
We are nearing the end of the year. Knowing how punctual we are with getting these out,
yeah.
This will probably come out, you know, like
February,
mid and December.
Yeah,
February. And so I thought it would be cool to talk about our favorite movies of the year.
Yeah.
Which quickly turned into, why don't we each pick a movie?
Yeah, we don't have to do that. We can just talk about our favorite movies of the year.
Well, I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about other favorites we had, but we won't get into depth, but we're basically forcing each other to watch one movie we each haven't seen that the other really, really liked.
Now, I think caveat to this before we give our picks, we both watch a lot of movies. So I think, at least for me, my intention was to pick a movie you had not seen yet that I really liked this year. So I definitely have a few that I like more than the one that I've picked, but this is an excellent film that I am surprised that Bobby has not yet seen that I would like to talk with him about. So do you want to go first?
They're both going to end up being pretty mainstream children's movies.
Oh,
too.
Sweet. What is yours? I actually don't know what yours is.
Well, why don't you tell me yours?
So I am picking a movie that I was very nervous about and extremely happy was as good as it was, which is Incredibles 2. First thing, and well, the only thing I'll really say about Incredibles 2, other than that it's just fucking great, is it literally starts the second the first movie ends. So it might behoove you to refamiliarize yourself with the first one, depending on how well you remember it. But it is a direct sequel in every understanding of that word to the first film. It starts with the fight that they have with the Underminer, who is the bad guy that pops up out of the concrete at the track meet at the end of the first movie.
Played by Pixar regular John Ratzenberger.
Yep. So, very, 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 very good movie. One of my favorite Pixar movies was, the first one was, and this one is just great. It's a absolutely perfect sequel.
I was pretty sad that I missed it in theaters.
Yeah, so, why did
I'm
you? Just out of curiosity, did it just didn't happen?
You know, we had brief plans to watch it with some friends, mm-hmm. me and my girlfriend Laura, and then we ended up bailing on that, and then we just never made it to theater. This would have been a great time because MoviePass was still MoviePass at that time.
Yeah. Oh man, those were the days. I don't know if I've told you about my MoviePass experience, right? Shannon bought me a year of Movie Pass for my birthday, and then the company went bankrupt a month later.
Did you get to use it at all?
I saw three movies, and then Movie Pass died.
A month ago, I was debating whether or not to keep my subscription or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then I looked at my movie history, and the last movie I had seen was Mamma Mia: Here We Go Again, which was several months ago. And I'm like, oof.
Yeah, they suck.
Which is good, because I would not have watched that movie without MoviePass.
It was it was a beautiful time while it lasted, and you were telling me that entire time, get in on it while it lasts, and I didn't listen.
Because this is too good to be true. It was.
Yeah.
You know, they funded, they tried to get into the movie funding business, too, while they were at the peak of their popularity.
Sure. How much cocaine do you think was involved at, like, the top levels of that organization? Because that's you know gotta be the answer, funded? Right? Huh.
You know what movie they funded, Ian?
What?
Gaudy.
Yeah, so I'm gonna ask again, how much cocaine do you I actually knew that. I knew that, and I totally forgot about it. That's right. Yeah, fucking weird ass time, man. It's
I had seriously considered MoviePass has been around for a while, and I had considered subscribing when it was $40 a month.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is this worth it for me? Will this save me money? And I'm like, this is I don't know. I'd have to watch X amount of movies, and I don't know if I would. And then they're like $9.99, which is less than the price of one movie ticket. You can watch as many movies as you want. And I'm like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard, but of course I'm going to do it.
It's so insane. Well, I when I picture the CEO of MoviePass at that time, I picture what's his name from Sorry to Bother You, the coked out Elon Musk character that
Armie Hammer.
Thank you, Armie Hammer plays. Armie Hammer has such a fucking fake sounding name, I never remember it. Because in my head, I'm like, it sounds like a G.I. Joe character, and that's all I got.
I was talking to one of my friends, mm-hmm. who makes a point not to watch non-fiction movies, uh-huh. like movies based on real events. And I was mentioning that.
Wait, he never watches fictional films?
Non-fictional.
He never watches non-fictional films.
He tends to not.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. Got it. That makes more sense. Fine. I accept that.
But I was trying to sell The Social Network on him,
sure.
which is one of my favorite movies. And I was like, Armie Hammer plays twins. And he goes, why wouldn't they just get twins? And I'm like, well, he plays the Winklevoss twins. And then he paused. He goes, yeah, that makes sense. They don't look human.
Okay, Bobby, what's your pick for next week?
All right, my pick. I feel a little embarrassed because I feel like this is like the mainstream hipster pick now for movie of the year, but this is a movie that plays right into my favorite genre of narrative, which I've talked about before.
Also, Bobby, you're a bit of a mainstream hipster. That's okay. You can own that.
Fuck you.
Bobby, let's talk about cereal some more.
Cereal's
really good. Go ahead.
It's really good. All three seasons. People tell you season two is no good, but they're wrong. It's good. But, you know, I've mentioned before that my favorite type of story has a good, ideologically pure character entering an environment and changing it by just being decent.
Sure. Like Spider-Man.
And so, what did you say?
Like Spider-Man.
Like Spider-Man. Yeah. And so I'm going to pick Paddington 2.
That's right. I have been hearing about these Paddington movies for a very long time. I probably will watch both, although I don't expect we'll talk about the first one. But everyone has been telling me for the last 3 years that these movies are actually incredible. Not just you. In fact, you actually have not talked to me about them as much as I would have expected you to, seeing that you're into them. But yeah,
Paddington 1 is actually like a very beautiful fable
that's what everybody keeps saying.
Immigration.
Yeah, that's what everybody keeps saying. That's what I assumed that there was some kind of like social identity politics component to the movie simply because of the people who were saying that it was a beautiful movie, and what politics I know they hold, but I don't know anything about it, and I don't like in my head still I kind of can't pick. All I know about Paddington is that he like goes down a flight of stairs in a bathtub in the trailer. That's like the only thing I know about it. Yeah, so
there's a lot of kind of like bonkers Looney Tunes physical
comedy. No, I'm fine with that. I love that shit.
But all you, even if you don't watch the first movie, all you need to know is Paddington is a bear from Peru who was raised by his uncle and aunt who dreamed of going to London because they had met an explorer from London decades before.
Was it Billy Idol?
It was not. No.
That would have been kind of cool.
It would have, you know. If only you were in the writer's room.
I know.
But it's our struggle, right, Ian? It's just, this is our life, you know, just the
just being smarter than everybody else. Yeah, I know.
It must be so hard. Tragedy befalls. His uncle dies and his aunt isn't strong enough to make it to London.
Okay.
And so she sends Paddington on his way to lead a better life.
And he just leaves her. So this is a movie about a selfish asshole.
He leaves her behind at the home for retired bears, which sounds like a euphemism you create.
Mm-hmm. It's a farm.
Before you put a bear down. Yeah. But we see the home for retired bears. It is a real thing.
Well, I mean, it's a real facade that has a... marmalade.
What did you say? I'm sorry.
I don't know what I said. I'm more fascinated now by the fact that you felt that was important information to lay on me, was that Paddington loves
marmalade.
It
is actually very important information that Paddington is obsessed with marmalade.
Okay, good
that
to know.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. God, you are such a hipster.
So I'm excited to talk about Paddington.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about a couple of kids' movies next time, so join us. thank you, Bobby, for reading Spider-Man. I was nervous about this one because, well, this is one, like I said, I've been into this since junior high. I've read the More Than Story 300 times. It's hard to tell at that point whether something is nostalgia or not, but I feel like this is a really strong series. So I'm glad you agree.
Nothing else. If people don't want to put up with reading like 10 issues of a comic book series, you could just read The Conversation.
Yeah, The Conversation's great. It's a single issue. Yeah. It's really fantastic. And it's one of the most famous comics in the Spider-Man history. So, yeah. Anyway.
It's wonderful. It's really good.
All right.
All right, man. Till next time.
You're not going to say something?
Dream big and fly to your...
Yeah, okay. Heart. Bye.
You're